Slow Burn Media, an evergreen podcast, presents Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless.
It's been 20 years since that steamy July morning when a screaming man hailed police and led them to the morgue that was Jeffrey Dahmer's West Side apartment.
Dahmer eventually detailed for police a ghastly record of torture and death. 12 News' Colleen Henry is here with a 12 News investigation. And Colleen, some questions whether we'll ever know the true extent of Dahmer's horrors.
Well, Kath, Jeffrey Dahmer gave a 159-page confession, but the FBI profiler on the case believes the serial killer kept secrets.
The secrets revealed on July 22, 1991, stunned the world and shook the law enforcement establishment. How could Jeffrey Dahmer have killed so many for so long without anyone noticing?
There was really no trail that led to him until a young man escaped. It could still be going on.
Neil Pertell is the retired Wisconsin FBI profiler assigned to the Dahmer case. He doubts we'll ever know the real extent of Dahmer's crimes.
I think very few people ever disclose everything. They always hold something back. That's their power. That's their control.
Jeffrey Dahmer committed his first known murder at age 18, the second 9 years later.
They don't stop. I mean, he started after high school. They don't stop.
Pertell says it's unlikely Dahmer didn't kill during the 9 years between those murders. Dahmer spent the first 2 years after the first murder in the Army, stationed in Germany.
His roommate, while he was in the military, has received a disability, in great part because of Dahmer's activity toward him.
After Dahmer's arrest, that Army roommate alleged 18 months of rape and torture at Dahmer's hands on this website. And German detectives traveled here to question Dahmer about five still unsolved murders near his Army base.
We don't know if he was what he was involved in Europe, in Germany, when he was with the military there.
The Army booted Dahmer for drinking and insubordination and shipped him from Germany to South Florida, where a different homicidal drama soon played out.
He's our only child, beautiful little boy, and we just want him back.
A transient Dahmer was working part-time at a sub shop and sleeping on the beach when the heartbreaking abduction and murder of six-year-old Adam Walsh captured national headlines. The Walsh case soon turned cold until Dahmer's arrest 10 years later, and his front-page photos sparked a flurry of calls to police claiming Dahmer was Adam's abductor.
Dahmer was there. Four people who were at that mall identified him after he was arrested by Milwaukee police. They saw his photograph and said, that's the guy that we encountered.
Dahmer denied killing Adam, so police ruled him out and closed the Walsh case 3 years ago without new evidence, blaming it on another dead serial killer. The former FBI profiler believes Dahmer is the more likely suspect.
It's a leap of imagination to think a person like this now let loose and drinking a lot and unemployed and stressed out in Florida wouldn't have engaged in something. It just would be a leap.
I think Dahmer would have graciously told the coppers that if he'd done anything to that boy.
Dahmer's lawyer believes his client revealed all his secrets after his arrest, noting Dahmer's confession ran more than 150 pages.
He wanted to unload things that they didn't even know happened, probably because that's how mentally ill he was, I think. He just wanted to tell him everything.
But Jerry Boyle concedes Dahmer fooled him early on. Boyle defended Dahmer against charges he sexually assaulted a 13-year-old 3 years before his murder arrests.
I would have bet the farm that he wasn't ever capable of hurting anybody.
Boyle would later learn that at the time of that sexual assault case, Dahmer had already committed four murders.
Dahmer was murdered in prison in 1994. The profiler says he visited Dahmer routinely before his death and continued to question him about Adam Walsh. He says Dahmer initially denied killing Adam, but later commented that whoever killed Adam Walsh would not survive in prison. He also said Dahmer noted that Florida has the death penalty, Kat.
Some fascinating perspective from the FBI profiler, and you're going to have more from him tomorrow morning?
Yeah, we're going to hear from him, and we're going to hear from Jerry Boyle, the attorney. They don't generally agree on this case, except on this one thing. Tomorrow, on the actual anniversary of Dahmer's arrest, you're going to hear why they believe, both of them, that it would have been better if Dahmer were still alive.
Jeffrey Dahmer is also back. He's back on the street. And, well, when you're Jeffrey Dahmer and you get released from prison, you probably go back to doing the same thing you did before. So, it was only a few months after being released from jail that Dahmer killed Raymond Smith, who was a 32-year-old prostitute. And, of course, he used $50 as an offer for sex. His classic move of drugging Smith at his North 25th Street apartment, Dahmer, of course, then strangled him with his hands, and this is when he took Polaroid pictures of the corpse in those suggestive poses that I talked about when those police discovered those Polaroids. Interesting stuff. So, he dismembered the body in the bathroom. Now, this is when Dahmer boiled the remains, dissolved them in a container of acid, except for Smith's skull, which he kept in a cabinet alongside Sears' skull. Why not? I mean, geez. So, you'd think that this would cause a stink, right? Well, neighbors complained of the smell emanating from his apartment. Dahmer told them his refrigerator was broken and he was waiting to get it fixed. Well, that's interesting, because not even a month later, guess what he does again? Kills somebody else. This one was 27-year-old Edward Smith. Now, he tried to retain the body by keeping it in a freezer for several months. The frozen corpse was eventually thrown away. With authorities, he told the authorities that he was upset he did not get to keep any of Smith's body parts due to degradation in the freezer. Jeffrey Dahmer. So, Dahmer, let's go back. Here we go. So that was in June. So you have a summer. So you have June, let's see, July and August, where he doesn't kill anybody, apparently. Well, he made it till September before the Dahmer in him struck again. And this would be Ernest Miller, who was 22. Now, this murder was a little different. He actually slashed his throat. And that was because he had a lack of sleeping pills, I guess. And this is also when Dahmer kept parts of Miller's body to eat. This is something that apparently he had begun doing more recently. And then he painted and displayed Miller's head in his apartment. Okay. All right. Getting a little, yeah, this is pretty awful stuff. So, here we have the 10th victim, and Dahmer picked this unfortunate 17-year-old up, and this was Curtis Strotter, at a bus stop. And, of course, he offered him money for nude photos. I don't know what the deal is with people taking money for nude photos. If somebody offers you guys money for nude photos, anybody, say no, please. It's ridiculous. So, anyway, offers of cash to a stranger, drugging and strangling his victim before taking photos, dismembering and keeping body parts for cannibalism and trophies, which were all of Dahmer's rituals. So, following his arrest, Dahmer said eating his victims was a compulsion, a way of, quote, making me feel they were a part of me. Again, disgusting. Now, in April 1991, Dahmer has an ingenious idea. According to Dahmer, I'm not saying this is ingenious by any stretch, because what does he attempt to do? This was before the rise of the zombie shows, but he wanted to create his own zombies. So after drugging 19-year-old Earl Lindsay, Dahmer drilled a hole in his skull, into which he poured hydrochloric acid in an attempt to produce what Dahmer would describe as, quote, a zombie-like state in his victim. Lindsay regained consciousness before Dahmer drugged him further and then strangled him and flayed the corpse with the intention of retaining Lindsay's skin. Okay, guys, we're getting to the point where this is just, it's almost too awful to even, like, to read. But he continues on. I mean, his next victim was 31-year-old now, so he moves his age group up here a little bit. Dahmer's next victim was 31-year-old Anthony Hughes. Now, let's see, how do I say this? So Anthony Hughes was actually dead, and his body was still intact on the floor when he still had the desire to go out and get somebody else. So this is when he went out and got 14-year-old Conorak Sintasophone, again, I'm so sorry about the pronunciation, and brought him back to the apartment. So after photographing and drugging him, Dahmer again tried to render his victim brain dead by drilling into his skull and inserting acid. Now, he left the drugged body alongside Hugh's corpse while he left the apartment for a few hours. Now, this is when you really, really got to pay attention to how fucked up this stuff is. Returning in the earlier hours the following morning, Dahmer discovered a groggy young man sitting outside the apartment building with three women huddled around him, telling the women that this man was his friend. And Dahmer attempted to lead the boy back to the apartment to the dismay of the women, who informed Dahmer they had already called the police. Dahmer eventually convinced attending police that this young boy was his 19-year-old boyfriend and that they had quarreled after drinking too much. Now, again, yeah, lots of missed opportunities here, guys. Amid protests of the women, the officers escorted Dahmer and the young boy back to the apartment, where Dahmer produced the Polaroids he had taken earlier as proof of their relationship. You really kind of hoped that he would have just kind of opened up the door then. So anyway, they categorized the event as a domestic dispute, and the three officers left the little boy in the apartment with the monster Jeffrey Dahmer. But they did note a strange smell. But did they do anything about it? I don't know. But he did try to commit another zombie-like character, so he injected his brain full of acid. And this time there were fatal results. And it's interesting. So this is coincidence, and this is mentioned in the article, that the young man was actually the younger brother of a boy Dahmer had molested in 1988. And that was the crime for which he was convicted, and we talked about earlier. So Dahmer had actually no idea that they were connected. So after dismembering their bodies, Dahmer kept the skulls of both Hughes and this young man's. In June of 1991, Dahmer lures in another victim with the promise of a photo. Dahmer, classically, met 20-year-old Matthew Turner in Chicago and persuaded him to travel to Milwaukee for a photo shoot. Once again, Dahmer drugged, strangled, and dismembered his victim, keeping the head and internal organs in plastic bags in his freezer. I mean, this guy is really stepping it up right now, because between July 7th and the 19th in 1991, he kills three more people. He chose a victim in Chicago, Jeremiah Weinberger, who was 20. And Dahmer did not commit the murder until the day following their arrival back at his apartment. Weinberger voiced his intention to leave, and we know Dahmer does not like that. Remember, Stephen Hicks? You know, so days later, after agreeing to pose nude, 24-year-old Oliver Lacey accompanied Dahmer back to his apartment, where Lacey was drugged and then administered chloroform over the course of a day in an attempt to render him alive but unconscious. After strangling Lacey, Dahmer had sex with the corpse, storing the head and heart in the refrigerator and the skeleton in a freezer. 4 days after murdering Lacey, Dahmer was fired from his job. The same day, Dahmer lured Joseph Bredehoff, 25, to his apartment, who he strangled and was laying on the bed where it remained for 2 days. And he then placed Bradhoff's head in the refrigerator. So, wow, right? That's pretty crazy, because it was not too long after he was doing these last three murders that he was finally caught. Now, you think it is one of those coincidences that he I don't know. it's hard to understand this whole, the whole thing. You know, I want to read a little bit here from the Akron Beacon Journal's deep dive into, sorry, Ben, I know you hate that phrase, but I just used it. So, Bill O'Connor, who was a Beacon staff writer, wrote, "The horrible and gruesome details of the murders in Milwaukee exploded onto the front pages of the nation's newspaper Wednesday, stunning readers. Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer, a former Bath Township resident, is accused of murdering as many as 17 men. Severed heads were found in his refrigerator. Body parts were found floating in a vat of acid. Police said Dahmer admitted to having sex with the corpse of one of his victims. They said he cut out the heart of another, intending to eat it. On Friday, Beacon Journal readers saw a front page picture of Dahmer, a picture that deepened the confusion. They saw a handsome, surprised that they would say that, outwardly calm 31-year-old quietly conferring with his attorney. And to all outward appearances, Jeffrey Dahmer was simply a fellow human being. But if he did what he is accused of, and police say he has confessed, Dahmer seems to be calling into question the very definition of human. Was he, in fact, some sort of monster simply disguised as one of us?" The article goes on to ask. That was the question residents of a four-story apartment house in Milwaukee have been asking. Beacon Journal reporter Bob Springer in Milwaukee, to report the story, said that Dahmer's neighbors, like the rest of the nation and much of the world, first wanted to know what happened. But as the enormity of the inhuman cruelty of these deeds began to emerge, Dahmer's neighbors had difficulty coming to terms with it. Their perception of reality was suddenly blurred, knocked out of focus. After all, they had known this man, seen him, exchanged innocuous pleasantries with him. This left confusion and fear. Pamela Bass, 38, and her husband lived across the hall from Dahmer. He was in apartment 213, the Bass is in 214. Bass had visited Dahmer and chatted while sitting on top of a freezer. Quote, "How could he let me sit right on top of that freezer knowing there was a human head inside?" Pamela Bass's confusion was akin to what was felt by Dahmer's former neighbors in the Akron area where he grew up. Dahmer was born in Milwaukee on May 21, 1960, but did grow up in Summit County at a home on West Bath Road in Bath Township. As I mentioned before, his father was a research chemist for PPG Industries, and his wife Joyce are parents of two boys, Jeffrey and his younger brother David. Now, again, just like almost every serial killer you hear about, this is what you get. He was a respectful boy. The year the Dahmers moved to West Bath Road, Jeffrey and Ted Lear, both fourth graders, caught the school bus at the same stop and rode it to Bath Elementary. Two boys sitting together on a school bus, traveling from comfortable homes in a well-to-do suburb to a clean, modern school. They were learning about their world, their society, learning its rules and regulations. Along with reading and writing, they were learning social skills, how to share their world with others. Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted were grade school pals. But friends, especially youthful ones, drift apart. And by the early to mid-70s, the pals gradually went their separate ways. They ran with different crowds in high school. Ted doesn't really recall seeing Dahmer after high school. Lear's mother remembers when Dahmer took over Ted's Beacon Journal paper route one summer during his junior year, and that was while they were vacationing. Quote, "I see this little blonde-haired boy, blue-eyed, always treated me with such respect. I'm shaking right now. Jeff was very polite, well-mannered. It's very hard for me to understand that this young man I knew really don't know what his childhood was like. There has to be something there." Years later, in 1981, Sue Lear bumped into Jeffrey Dahmer in a Click store. "I talked with him. I said, 'Hi, Jeff, how are you?' He said he was at Ohio State. He then went into the Army. He was in the military police. I asked him what his plans were, and she said he wanted to join the FBI. Sue Lear looks across the years and sees the promises that dead-ended with screaming headlines. She said she doesn't feel sympathy, not with the crimes that were committed. Then she remembered again. He was a tall boy, very friendly." So, of course, obviously, he took a wrong turn. So Ted Lear, Jeff's buddy, grew up to be a computer engineer, according to the Beacon Journal. He earned a doctorate from Carnegie Mellon University. Quote, it's hard for me to believe this was a boy I played with as a kid, Lear said. He was weird, but I met a lot of weird people in grad school, too. Lear had difficulty with the news that his boyhood chum did not evolve into a graceful human being, but developed instead a twisted mind. Quote, he was funny. When we were kids, he would make funny comments about things. He had a predilection for when an adult would call morbid things, but interesting things. He was curious about living things. I don't want to paint a bleak picture of him because he was a fun kid to be around as a child. But he had his odd ways, Lear said. Quote, he wasn't a bully or malicious, but he wouldn't be sympathetic to someone who was hurt. He wouldn't be the first person to come to someone's aid. He would laugh. Others noticed what Lear saw as Dahmer grew into his teens, his behavior becoming more insular. Quote, when we got to high school, he was kind of a solemn person, Lear said. Quote, he wasn't as funny. We partied, and our paths diverged. He continued on along with his craziness. They used to make Jeff Dahmer jokes in high school. I remember some science classes, he was fairly out of control. Lear, like his mother, finds that Jeffrey Dahmer he once knew is out of focus, or rather it is the young Dahmer who is in focus. What he apparently becomes blurry is, quote, he was an intelligent kid. He just took a wrong turn. So the Beacon dives into his drinking a little bit more, and this is what I talked about earlier when he started drinking in his really early teens. So whatever was in Dahmer, the boy, whatever seed of unfeeling or coldness seems to have been nurtured by a couple of things in his life. One was the divorce of his parents. The other was booze. Joyce and Lionel Dahmer were divorced in 1978 after what court records indicate was a stormy battle. Relatives and friends said they noticed a marked change in Jeffrey's behavior after the divorce. Lionel Dahmer married Jeffrey's stepmother, Sherry, shortly after the divorce, and Jeffrey, who was 18, lived with the couple. Little has been learned about Jeffrey's relationship with his mother. High school acquaintances said he drank often, as early as the beginning of junior high school, like I mentioned before. Remember, he was drinking scotch by 14. And by 18, drinking was a serious problem. His father told the Milwaukee Sentinel that Jeffrey often drank until he was stupefied, that he got into bar fights and sometimes forgot where he parked the family car. Oh, Jeff, you crazy fool. Dahmer did attend Ohio State University briefly, luckily for the campus. That was a brief stay. But did do a stint in the medical unit and trained in cardiac care. He was eventually stationed in Germany, but again, he was discharged because of his alcoholism. So where does Jeffrey go here? Well, Jeffrey returns to the United States in the early 80s, and he actually works at a Florida sandwich shop at a time. And then he returned to Ohio to live with his father, but obviously no solution is caused by moving, or no problem is caused by moving, blah, 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 blah. You know what I'm trying to say. But the interesting thing, and this is where I'm going to go on a little tangent here, because this is where we talk about Adam Smith. Adam Smith was my college roommate. Now we're going to talk about Adam Walsh and the possibility that Jeffrey Dahmer could have committed this crime. Well, I would say the chances are very low, just because of location. We do have Otis Toole admitting to the murder, but that's sort of been questioned over the years. I mean, John Walsh has sort of come to terms with it being Otis Toole or Otis O'Toole or whatever his name is. The Dahmer side of things, I mean, John Walsh has come out and said he does not believe that it was Jeffrey Dahmer, but it definitely is an interesting, storyline to take because, he was in Florida. Adam disappeared while he was playing video games at a Sears, and I don't believe that there was a good description of anybody, but I think it's just the fact that people go back and they do this sort of, we were doing it a lot these days. redefining history or doing revisionist history. That's the word I'm looking for. So, yes, Jeffrey Dahmer was in Florida. Did Adam Walsh get killed there? Yes, he did. Is there a chance that Jeffrey Dahmer committed the crime? I mean, if we're going to play the game of, like, one in a million? So you're saying there's a chance? I guess there's a chance, but I'm not going to put any... I'm not holding out hope that there was some crazy connection between Dahmer and this poor young boy. So Dahmer, again, is back in Ohio, and I'm back in the Akron Beacon Journal article. And this is when the situation at home became impossible. Dahmer moved in with his paternal grandmother, Catherine, in West Alice, a Milwaukee suburb. Okay, real quick, West Alice. Kind of interesting connection there, too. If you recall, Amy Mahalovic's family is actually from that area. And that's just kind of weird. I'm not going to say anything like there was some connection, because we know that he liked boys and Amy was definitely a girl. So, not going down that route, just saying, kind of interesting that he's from Amy's parents' hometown. Kind of weird. So, again, there were hints that Dahmer might be homosexual early on. In 1985, he took a job at the Ambrosia Chocolate Company, and this was in a worn-down neighborhood on the Milwaukee's near west side. Now, in 1988, he moved to the Oxford Plaza, which was a short distance from the factory. Now, about a month later, police said that Dahmer had enticed the 13-year-old boy to his apartment for sex. Now, this boy overdosed on a sleeping drug supplied by Dahmer, and the crime was revealed, convicted. That, you know, this is the case where he gets convicted and goes to jail for a year. So basically, Jeffrey never received any help, and he was never visited by a probation officer. Probation authorities said the parole officer had too heavy a caseload and that the neighborhood Dahmer lived in made visits potentially dangerous. Instead, Jeffrey Dahmer visited the probation officer. The arrangement proved deadly, obviously. Outwardly, Dahmer was just a blue-collar worker, and, you know, he'd return to his one tiny one-bedroom apartment, and he was just a quiet loner. I mean, this is, again, all the reporting from the ABJ. I mean, this is great stuff. But there was another Dahmer, according to the Akron Beacon Journal, roaming around the city, a warped, wounded individual driven by some sort of cold, savage fury. Now, I don't want to go into too much detail, but there are some examples here about what Dahmer did, and this is according to reports from police who interviewed him. Now, it was on June 30th that Dahmer went to the gay pride parade in Chicago, and while waiting to take the bus home, struck up a conversation with Matt Turner, who also went by the name Donald Montrell. Although 10 years his junior and black, Turner had one thing in common with Dahmer. Both were gay and open to risky alliances. Dahmer suggested that Turner ride to Milwaukee with him, and Turner accepted. Dahmer also said he would pay for Turner to pose nude. So they boarded a Greyhound bus, and when they arrived in Milwaukee, Dahmer hailed a cab. At his apartment, Dahmer offered Turner a drink and sat with him while Turner drank. The drink was drugged, of course. And so when Turner passed out, Dahmer took a strap and wrapped it around the neck and twisted the strap until Turner could not breathe. After a few minutes of intense effort, Turner was dead. And then Dahmer cut off Turner's head and placed it in the freezer. Catching the theme here. Now, again, remember Jeremiah Weinberger? He picked him up at Carol's Gay Bar on Wells Street. And this was again in Chicago. Now, they took the Greyhound bus, then a taxi. They got back to Dahmer's place and had oral sex, and Weinberger actually stayed the night. And this is, again, the next day Weinberger said he wanted to leave. Dahmer offered him a drink. Hey, guess what? The drink was drugged. And when he passed out, of course, what do you think he did? He strangled him, then took photos of the corpse. And then what do you think he did? Took off his head. On that note, let's take a moment to hear from this week's sponsor. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. online therapy. We all know relationships take work, especially the most important one you have in your life, and that's the relationship with yourself. A lot of us will drop anything to go help someone we care about. We'll go out of our way to treat other people well. But how often do we do that for ourselves and give ourselves the same treatment? I know that I go out of my way to take time each day to focus on myself. It's an essential part of my routine. This month, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you that you matter just as much as everyone else does, and therapy is a great way to make sure that you show up for yourself. Listeners of this show know I'm a huge fan of mental health, and I have personally been in therapy since I was a child. So, BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Who Killed listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/who. That's BetterHelp.com/who. All right, we are back. Yeah, you know, so 10 days later, that was when lured Oliver Lacey to his apartment. That's when he put the Lacey's head and put it in a box and put that in the fridge. Then he cut out Lacey's heart. As I told you, he intended to eat it later. So, you know, it's basically one of those things you kind of just look at, all right, well, here we are. Everything pretty much ended that one day where the police were flagged down by Tracy Edwards. I mean, if it wasn't for Edwards escaping that apartment, that probably would have led to more murders. I mean, I guarantee it would have led to more murders. Although I would say that the fact that he was committing so many murders in such a short period of time, that it would have been crazy. Now, there's a whole nother chapter we could talk about Jeffrey Dahmer. And I will say that some of the staff writers that worked on that story were Regina Brett, Robert Holes, Eric Sandstrom, and Bill O'Connor. And so basically, Dahmer goes to jail. He's an awful person. And what happens when awful people go to jail? Well, in some situations, some people are put in solitary confinement because they're very high-profile inmates. You'd think Jeffrey Dahmer would be one of those people, but I would say that wasn't the case, because the murder of Jeffrey Dahmer, didn't see that coming, unless you did. So the murder of Jeffrey Dahmer, according to the AP, was allowed to happen, his mother said, although investigators and a panel of expats didn't believe and didn't come to that conclusion. Referring to prison officials, Joyce Flint said, "As I saw how it all happened, they had discretionary power as to who would be around him. I think something was allowed to happen to Jeff." During an interview by telephone from her home in Fresno, California, Flint said she didn't blame the man who killed her son because he was as mentally ill as her son. However, Flint didn't want to talk about her son's death as much as she wanted to talk about a hope that she has that something good would come out of what happened. Quote, "I'm reduced to begging on what happened to my son. What she is begging for is that a doctor be permitted to study her son's brain." Flint was told this week that her son's remains will be cremated soon, possibly in days. Quote, "When I think of what Jeff did, I just stop breathing. I haven't seen one speck of light with all this horror that happened to everyone. I want something useful to come from this nightmare. This is the last thing and the only thing that I can do. Jeff is not the last serial killer we're going to read about. Maybe this could help." Jeffrey Dahmer, who confessed to murdering and dismembering 17 young men and boys, was one of two prisoners murdered by an inmate last November at the Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage. 2 months ago, in a letter to Lionel Dahmer, Candace Scrapek, a psychologist and criminologist who has studied serial killers for 11 years, wrote, quote, what is needed to proceed is your kind agreement to help us accomplish something useful on Jeff's behalf as well as your own, and in memory of the victims. Lionel Dahmer did not reply to the first request that he permit the body to Jeffrey Dahmer's brain. And, quote, maybe we can shame him into it, Flint said bitterly of her ex-husband. Quote, if we have an opportunity to have his brain studied, why not take it? It might help. Skrapik also wrote that she had contacted Dr. Jonathan Pincus. He was a renowned neurologist, and he had expressed sincere interest in stressed the importance of such a research opportunity. In a letter in July, Skrapik asked Stephen, who is the personal representative of Dahmer's estate, if he would ask the father to respond. Eisenberg did not respond either. So, you know, by his father's account, Jeffrey Dahmer was in his new apartment for only one day before trouble began. And this is according to reports. You know, records say Dahmer fondled a boy, asked him to look sexier. You know, we're just kind of going over and over here of what Dahmer did. But it's really kind of fucked up just how many opportunities there were to solve this case before 17 people were murdered. I mean, he will go down as the most disgusting and probably, I don't know if disgusting is a word, the most grisly, most unflinching, what words can you describe him? Merciless, insane, sick. Just all these things are just, they cover him. I mean, it's like, it's really weird, you know, like, I just think if we wouldn't have had that man escape on the 22nd of July, we would have been talking about a lot more murders. I think this is kind of, I don't know, I think you really have to watch some of those interviews. I will send you to YouTube. I'll provide some clip options on YouTube or on the show notes for you to watch some interviews with him. He really doesn't seem like the serial killer type. I'm just referring to Dahmer and the comparisons to like BTK, who really seems like he enjoys talking about his murders, where Jeffrey Dahmer seems more like he was just so fucking sick that he couldn't control himself. And again, we have this whole year, 9 year span where he doesn't do anything. And according to Robert Holmes of the University of Louisville, who was a criminologist and an expert on serial killers, he said there is no way that Dahmer killed in 1978 and then again until the mid-1980s. Quote, somewhere along the way, he's killed between there, Holmes said. Quote, it just takes too long. I'm not saying 17 or 20 of them, but I'm saying probably at least 4 or 5 or 6 in there someplace. According to Holmes, serial killers follow certain time patterns. Dahmer's apparent switch from white to black victims, Holmes said the only significance was availability. When he lives in a black neighborhood, he kills black victims. As for homosexuality, Dr. Ashok Betty, a clinical director of the Milwaukee Psychiatric Hospital, says it plays a very, very minor part of the equation because homosexuality is a, quote, normal, healthy choice for most people and deal with just as adaptively or maladaptively as people who make heterosexual choices. Without having examined Dahmer, Betty said, it seems apparent that he, quote, really has a lot of confusion between sexuality and aggression. The two basic instincts of life forces. People are so regressed, have very little capacity to distinguish between the two. So when they are feeling sexual towards someone, they will show it by aggression. And that would include mutilating your victims, eating them, and making love to their dead body. Of course, this is all according to Dr. Betty. Yeah, pretty gross stuff. Now, Betty said that she was particularly struck by the killing spree that followed the call to Dahmer by his mother in March. Quote, she reconnected with him after 5 years, and then after that, he went into a sort of major escalation of his problems. Well, I think we might have just found the answer. Obviously, there was something major unresolved at that level. He lost control or whatever little tenuous control he had and went into this frenzy, almost asking to be caught. And that's what I said before. Like, I think that he was reaching his tail end. I mean, killed 3 people in 3 days. Again, that's asking to be caught. He lived in a one-bedroom apartment. Again, it smelled, remember. So I think the big fear, this is what they said. Quote, I think the big fear this fellow has is one of abandonment. If you are rejected by the parent of the opposite sex, it is very devastating. And I think it looks like he found her again after many years. And, you know, he was probably feeling, at least on the inside, that he was in danger of losing her again. By creating this major crisis, you know, he thought she will now have to maintain some connection. No way is his face going to be blocked out from the picture. But again, at a very heavy price to society and to himself. And that will do it for our series on Jeffrey Dahmer. He is a monster, and we are all better off that he is no longer on this planet. I feel a little bit of empathy to him, just in the sense that he was so crazy, I think he couldn't control himself. But I am going to play you the interview that he did, or that was aired on MSNBC. And this was what they call his last interview before being arrested. And listen to it and tell me if he sounds like a serial killer, because he comes off pretty good. And you can tell, he just seems like a normal guy. But that does it for this week's episode. So when I'm done with my little outro, definitely listen to the interview. But for a reminder, I'm going to be back at CrimeCon on Podcast Row in Vegas, 2022, April 29th through May 1st. If you'd like to save money on your ticket, use my promo code WHOKILLED, and that's at crimecon.com. If you do enjoy this podcast, you can help support the show by contributing directly to my Venmo account at bill-huffman-3. I can provide a show link in the show notes as well. Every contribution does help keep these slow burn podcasts running. Now, you can also help support the show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Those 5 stars do help keep the important cases I cover in the spotlight. If you'd like to stay up to date on the cases that I have covered, as well as the new shows that I have in the pipeline, please do follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. Thank you so much again for listening. Until next week with Nick from True Crime Garage, be healthy and stay safe.
On the night of July 22, 1991, Milwaukee police finally discovered the horrendous secrets that Jeffrey Dahmer had been desperately hiding for many years. Acting on a tip from a young gay man who escaped from Dahmer's apartment, police searched number 213 and found a chamber of unimaginable horrors. Human heads and a heart wrapped and bagged in the freezer. Hands and feet at the bottom of his soup kettle. Skulls tucked away in a file cabinet, and this blue barrel stuffed with dismembered torsos soaking in acid. Dahmer would spend the next 24 hours confessing, telling in vivid detail of a murder spree that began in 1978 when he was 18 and ended with 17 young men dead.
I had this reoccurring fantasy of meeting a hitchhiker on the road, and of taking him hostage and doing what I wanted with him. And I never in my wildest nightmares thought that it would become a reality.
Why would Dahmer have, as he put it, created his own Holocaust? How did he become so filled with evil? It would be comforting to point to an abusive childhood, an early life filled with hatred or horror, but his was filled with love.
Jeff was the most beautiful darling, sweetest baby, the nicest young boy.
There just were no real signs when he was growing up.
Imagine your child grows up to be a murderer. Would you still love him? would the guilt and sense of responsibility be overwhelming? Jeffrey Dahmer's parents have struggled mightily to understand what might have gone wrong with their child. His father's search for an explanation led him to look inward, even to write a book simply titled A Father's Story. But his search may be in vain, because even the experts and profilers who've studied serial killers are baffled by why they do it.
There doesn't seem to be any indication in any of the serial murderers that something external makes them want to kill. It's as if something is thrown, a switch is thrown, and they begin on the pattern of what their pattern will be.
Maybe all we can do is what Lionel Dahmer did, look back and try to see what went wrong. As a young child at the beach with his parents, Jeffrey Dahmer discovered a dead crab. He examined it with a child's curiosity, but later the curiosity grew into something unthinkable.
All I know is that I wanted to see what the insides of these animals looked like. There may have been some violence involved, some underlying subconscious feelings of violence. It was a compulsion, became a compulsion.
Jeffrey Dahmer got bigger, and so did his compulsion to look at the insides of living things. He began to kill them, satisfying powerful urges that he didn't understand.
In ninth grade, in biology class, we had the usual dissection of fetal pigs, and I took the remains of that home and kept the skeleton of it, and I just started branching out, dogs, cats. I suppose it could have turned into a normal hobby like taxidermy, but it didn't. It veered off into this.
More and more, Dahmer killed animals in the woods behind his house. He knew it was wrong, but he couldn't stop. Then, at 14 or 15, it got worse.
I don't know, that became a compulsion, and it switched from animals to humans. I still don't understand it. I don't know why.
If your fantasy life as a teenager includes killing, who do you tell?
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable with anyone. So I just closed myself off and just put on a mask of normalcy.
As Jeffrey Dahmer entered adolescence, his secrets multiplied. He began to feel attracted to other young men. It was not an issue he could talk to his father about, but Jeffrey knew he was gay.
Started having obsessive thoughts of violence intermingled with sex. And it just got worse and worse. I didn't know how to tell anyone about it, so I didn't.
And just as Jeffrey was becoming aware of his internal violent sexual urges, his external life began to unravel. His parents' marriage, which had been rocky throughout his childhood, finally ended. He found himself alone more and more. And then one night, while his mother was away on a trip and his father newly moved into a motel down the street, a fantasy Jeffrey had been having for years came true, and the killing began.
I was 18 years old, driving home. I saw this hitchhiker about a mile from my house, and he caught my eye. I drove past him, thought to myself, should I stop and pick him up, or should I just keep on going? I wish I just kept on going, but I didn't. I turned around, picked him up, and that's when the nightmare became a reality. It just seemed so bizarre to me that this obsession that I had been thinking about and wanting, just all the parts are there. And they make it possible to make it happen, just at the time when it could happen, when there's nobody at the house for 2 weeks.
After the first time he murdered, Dahmer says that he tried to get control of himself,
and for 6 years he did not kill again. In 1984, he found himself living in Milwaukee, frequenting gay bars, when the violent sexual urges overcame him again.
I met this guy at one of the bars, downtown Milwaukee bars. We went back to the hotel. Just planning on getting drunk, I had put some sleeping pills in his drink to render him unconscious. And I was just gonna spend the night with him. When I woke up in the morning, my forearms were bruised and his chest was bruised and blood was coming out of his mouth. He was hanging over the side of the bed.
This type of behavior and the urge that develops, it's triggered. It doesn't go in cycles. It may be a place that he's in that reminds him of something. It may be something that he hears. It may be a certain season. It may just be a color. It's intimately connected with memory and previous experiences and something that goes on at an unconscious level.
Whatever it was, it came over Dahmer almost like a dream.
I have no memory of beating him to death, but I must have. And that's when it all started again. I had no intention of hurting him at all.
How could Dahmer not remember? It's hard for a normal person to imagine, but Dr. Helen Morrison believes that the brain functioning of serial murderers is unique.
Part of his mind is split off. Again, we have this piece of this puzzle that's somewhere that doesn't connect with the thinking part or the logical part. It's not far removed from those of us who drive every day and we drive the same route and we don't know how we got from point A to point B. We know we did it, but it doesn't enter our consciousness.
Unlike other serial killers who seem to actually derive satisfaction from the killing, Jeffrey Dahmer says he did not. His motivation, his objective was sexual. He wanted to create a sexual slave that he could totally control. And to that end, he performed the most horrific of experiments on his victims, literally drilling holes in their head.
I tried to create living zombies with muriatic acid in the drill, but it never worked. No, the killing wasn't the objective. I just wanted to have the person under my complete control to do with as I wanted.
Dr. Helen Morrison, who profiles these men, says part of the reason is because serial killers like Dahmer literally feel things differently than a normal person.
To the serial murderer, it's very similar to the young child who may pull the legs off of a daddy long legs or a fly to see what happens. There is no humanity there. It's just, oh, this is a very interesting thing. They do things to individuals that they've never experienced themselves. They want to see pain, or they want to see fear, or they want to see agony.
And with Dahmer, that experimenting included what had to be the most shocking part of this case. He sometimes ate his victims. An idea abhorrent to anyone with even vaguely human sensibilities. And yet, here again, Dr. Morrison says that, in fact, Dahmer's behavior makes a peculiar kind of psychological sense.
Jeffrey Dahmer was not the only individual who was a cannibal or bit his victims or used teeth as a weapon. If you remember about infancy, if we go purely psychologically, the only way an infant interacts with his world around him is through touch, feel, and teeth. And this is a way that babies explore their world with their mouths. That's what they use. That's how they relate to the world. And what is evident in all of the serial murderers is this trait of very oral, or mouthing, or biting, or eating, ingesting, which is highly infantile, but it seems to be a way in which they can be with their victim.
It made me feel like they were a permanent part of me. Besides the just mere curiosity of what it would be like, it made them feel that they were a part of me, and it gave me a sexual satisfaction to do that.
By the late 80s, Dahmer had spiraled completely into a free fall of killing. A serial killer was on the loose in Milwaukee, but why wasn't anyone noticing? Serial killer profiler Robert Ressler says it was easy for Dahmer to hide.
He was fairly good looking and very shy. And I think I've often said that in any college group, you could put him right in the middle of a college group and probably you would look at him as a decent young man.
And that was Dahmer's most powerful weapon in luring his victims into his world. 17 in total, they had several traits in common. They were all men, all young, mostly minorities, and almost all were gay. Starting in 1984, one by one, these men disappeared. But nobody in Milwaukee had any idea that a serial killer was on the loose. Annie Schwartz is a crime reporter for the Waukesha Freeman newspaper in Milwaukee.
It was very much business as usual before Jeffrey Dahmer was caught. Because of the nature of the victims, the kinds of people that he chose, they were people that for the most part weren't missed by their families. They were often people who were tossed aside by their families because they were gay or they had had problems with the police. He chose his victims very carefully. He chose people that wouldn't be missed.
If families were not missing the victims, Jeffrey Dahmer's family was missing clues that something was terribly wrong. There were close calls, like this one with his father, Lionel.
I had a box in my bedroom closet, and contained the mummified head and genitals of a young man I met in one of the bars down in Milwaukee. And it was a locked metal box. My dad 1 week came to visit and happened to see it and he was wondering what was in it. He didn't know. Nobody knew. I told him it was pornography, some magazines. And he wasn't satisfied with that answer. We got into a bit of an argument because I wouldn't open it up. He took the locked box down to the basement and was about to smash it open. But I came back in the house. We reconciled.
The reconciliation with his father would mean the lies would go on and that Jeffrey Dahmer would continue to hunt down victims in the gay bars of Milwaukee and kill them. But in a city with a relatively low crime rate, why were the police not connecting the murders? Dahmer's seeming normality helped him hide his reign of terror.
People like Dahmer can get away with this easier because law enforcement does not recognize him for what he is. They're looking for somebody who's dragging their knuckles on the pavement and baying at the moon with hair in their face. They're not looking for Mr. Nice Guy, the quiet young man living in the neighborhood.
But there may have been something more to why the murders went unnoticed.
Okay, hi, I'm on 25th and State, and this is young man, he is butt naked, he has been beaten up, he is very bruised up, he can't stand, he's study fall out, he is butt naked, he has no clothes on, he was really hurt. And I ain't got no corner on him. I just seen him, and he needs some help.
Where is he at?
On 25th and State, the corner of 25th and State.
He's just on the corner at the street?
Yeah, he in the middle of the street. He fell out. We trying to help him. Some people trying to help him.
Okay, and he's unconscious right now?
He getting him up, but he is bruised up. Somebody must have jumped on him and stripped him or whatever. Yeah.
The call is about this young man, Conorak Synthesyn Phone. The voice is that of a neighbor, Glenda Cleveland, who spotted the young man trying to escape Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment. Dahmer had already tried to perform his crude sex zombie experiment on the 14-year-old, drilling a hole in his head and pouring in acid. Drugged, bleeding, dazed, the young man had somehow managed to get away from Dahmer and yell for help. The police did come. Jeffrey Dahmer told the police that Synthesyn Phone was his 19-year-old lover with whom he'd been quarreling. The police went into Dahmer's apartment, saw nothing amiss, and returned the boy. The police then radioed back to the station, joking about what they had seen.
The intoxicated Asian naked male was returned to his sober boyfriend. My partner's gonna get deloused at the station.
A month later, when Jeffrey Dahmer was arrested, he admitted to killing Synthesyn Phone shortly after police left. The death would cost the two police officers their jobs and would force the entire city to look inward at attitudes and treatment of minorities and gays. There would be candlelight vigils and city decreed days of healing. But Jeffrey Dahmer would leave a black mark on Milwaukee.
The place where Dahmer's apartment building stood was razed and put a playground in. Raised all kinds of money from the community, and no one in the community wanted to use this playground because they said it was the devil's playground. I think that the city of Milwaukee, at the end of the Jeffrey Dahmer case, was left with the unfortunate realization that it can happen here. It being whatever horrific thing that you see on the news that you think happens in other places and to other people. There was the sad realization for people that live in the city of Milwaukee that it could and did happen here.
But of course, the deepest scars would be reserved for the victims' families and the family of the murderer.
Never, Jeffrey! Jeffrey, I hate you! This is out of control! Don't with me, Jeffrey, I'll kill you! Look at me, you took my mother's oldest grandchild from her, and for that I can never forgive you. I hope you can deal with what you've done.
The families of Jeffrey Dahmer's victims had their day in court and an opportunity to address him. Jeffrey Dahmer sat motionless throughout. His father, Lionel, sat behind him. Jeffrey's crimes had been a terrible shock for him, so much so that for the first 24 hours after he learned of them, he didn't believe Jeffrey's confession.
How can you see your son who's been riding a tricycle and running around with his dog, Frisky, and playing tennis with me, taking a knife and cutting a person open, and then doing sexual things with it? It's pretty hard.
Those who profile serial killers can understand why Lionel would have such trouble reconciling his baby boy with the adult killer who would perpetrate such sickening crimes.
We do know that when puberty comes, the ages of 13, 14, 15, that the hormones seem to interact with the brain chemistry, and we have no idea what that's doing or where it's coming from.
I think probably there was a mixture of feelings of anger and hate and disappointment and also feeling extremely sorry for what he did. Felt very sorry for victims and their families and also for Jeff, the terrible waste.
Both Lionel Dahmer and Joyce Flint, Jeffrey's mother, struggled to find a way to support their son in the face of his crimes, a brutal task for any parent to endure.
There's things so deeply locked up in his mind that even he doesn't know what's going on, and therefore I have to hug him.
It's almost like I don't have a right to mourn or grieve, because there are all these families who will never, ever speak to their children again.
By all accounts, Jeffrey Dahmer seemed to be relieved that he had been caught. He cooperated thoroughly with authorities and a battery of doctors and profilers who wanted to learn more about his behavior.
What was uncontrollable about Jeffrey Dahmer was the urge. It was the urge he couldn't control. It was the craving he had to satisfy. And that's why when he killed, he killed because he couldn't satisfy the urge any other way and had to do it immediately.
And this is something Dahmer seemed to know better than anyone. At his sentencing, he read a statement of apology for his crimes.
Your Honor, it is over now. This has never been a case of trying to get free. I didn't ever want freedom. Frankly, I wanted death for myself. This was a case to tell the world that I did what I did not for reasons of hate. I hated no one. I knew I was sick or evil or both. Now I believe I was sick. I know how much harm I have caused. I tried to do the best I could after the arrest to make amends, but no matter what I did, I could not undo the terrible harm I have caused. I know I will be in prison for the rest of my life.
The rest of Jeffrey Dahmer's life would last less than 2 years. In November of 1994, a fellow inmate of Dahmer's beat him to death. The killing occurred in a 20-minute period when the men were unguarded. Although Dahmer expressed repeated remorse for his actions, in the last interview he granted before his death, he made a stunning admission that he still had fantasies of killing.
It never completely goes away. I'll probably have to live with it for the rest of my life. I wish it would go away. I wish there was some way to completely get rid of the compulsive thoughts, the feelings. It's not nearly so bad now that there's no avenues to actually act on it. But no, it never seems to go completely away.
Ohio is a land of mystery. From missing shipwrecks and lost treasure beneath her surface to strange phenomena slicing through her skies. From myths that have evolved around historic events and people to the unsolved murders and disappearances that keep her communities wondering what happened. Find Ohio Mysteries on your favorite podcast app and let's explore the inexplicable. OhioMysteries.com.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.